The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 7, 2025. As usual, it is bordered in red on the front cover with a narrow white inner border, which actually becomes a gradation then of off-white to gray. Time, in large block capital lettering, is in a silver gray superimposed upon this grayish-whitish something background. And on the cover then is a photograph of an individual who is not named. He looks like a Middle Eastern leader. He has a black turban. He has gray facial hair. He's wearing glasses. And it looks like he's hidden. He is partly hidden by this grayish, whitish, partial cover image. Moving to the text. First of all, there's a photograph with a caption. The caption reads, Air India crash aftermath. The background of this photo is a beautiful blue sky, but the foreground is devastating. Into a cracked-looking tan desertscape is the tail portion and part of the wings, everything's partial here, of a tan-colored aircraft. I will read the caption. The site of the Air India plane crash in Meghaninagar area in India's western state of Gujarat. The plane, which was a Boeing 787 bound for London, crashed shortly after taking off, June 12. The crash killed 241 people on board and at least 29 people on the ground. Only one passenger, Vishwashkumar Ramesh, survived, which he called a miracle. Well, apparently the rest of this aircraft has either broken into pieces or remained submerged in this gray, brown, tan soil where it landed. Next, the bulletin, Minnesota shootings highlight the rise of political violence by Chantel Lee. The shootings of two Minnesota lawmakers and their spouses brought renewed attention to the rise in political violence across the U.S. in recent years. Democratic State Representative Melissa Hortman, that's H-O-R-T-M-A-N, and her husband Mark were shot and killed June 14 by a man who authorities say was impersonating a police officer. The same shooter attacked Democratic State Senator John Hoffman, H-O-F-F-M-A-N, and his wife Yvette, who were hospitalized with multiple gunshot wounds. Authorities said they were charging Vance Belter, that's B-O-E-L-T-E-R, in connection with both shootings. We are not a country that settles our differences at gunpoint, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said in a statement June 14. We must stand united against all forms of violence. President Donald Trump condemned the incident, saying, such horrific violence will not be tolerated in the United States of America. But later he criticized Walz. The attacks highlight a concerning pattern as U.S. lawmakers face an increased threat of political violence. The number of aggressive statements and direct threats against members of Congress, including their families and staff, investigated by the U.S. Capitol Police, has increased markedly within the past 7 years, jumping from 3,939 in 2017 to 9,625 in 2021, according to the agency. The past year has seen another spike. The Capitol Police investigated 9,474 direct threats and concerning statements in 2024, up from 8,008 the previous year. Among public officials attacked in recent years are former Representative Gabrielle Giffords of Arizona and Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana. In April, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's house was set on fire while he and his family were inside. And in 2022, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband was attacked by a man reportedly targeting her. While no lawmakers were wounded in the attack on the U.S. Capitol, January 6, 2021, the incident left more than 100 people injured, and at least 7 deaths were tied to the attack, according to a bipartisan Senate report. In the lead-up to the 2024 election, there were 2 attempts on Trump's life, including a shooting at a July 2024 rally in Pennsylvania that left him with a bleeding ear. Turning the page to the brief news, good question. Can the Musk-Trump feud ground NASA? By Jeffrey Kluger. June 5, as the feud between erstwhile besties, President Trump and Elon Musk, escalated, Trump posted on his Truth social platform, "The easiest way to save money in our budget, billions and billions of dollars, is to terminate Elon's government subsidies and contracts. I was always surprised Biden did not do it." About 90 minutes later, in a post on X, Musk clapped back, "In light of the president's statement about cancellation of my government contracts, SpaceX will begin decommissioning its Dragon spacecraft immediately." Not long after that post went wide, Musk quietly deleted it. Later that evening, an X user posted to Trump and Musk, "This is a shame, this back and forth. You are both better than this. Cool off and take a step back for a couple days." Minutes later, Musk responded, "Good advice. Okay, we won't decommission Dragon." That defused the immediate emergency, but questions remain about how dependent America's space efforts are on the whims of mercurial billionaires. Could Musk ground the nation? Could a stroke of Trump's Sharpie hobble SpaceX? The short answer in both cases is maybe, but not likely. There is no overstating how central SpaceX has become in the space sector in the 23 years since it was founded as the Space Exploration Technologies Corporation. Since the inaugural flight of the company's Falcon 9 in 2010, the rocket has become the world's workhorse vehicle for rides to orbit, with 485 completed missions, including 440 acrobatic landings of its reusable first stage. The rocket and its Dragon spacecraft provide regular service to the International Space Station, ISS. In 2024, the company's larger Falcon Heavy launched NASA's Europa Clipper spacecraft to Jupiter's moon Europa. It is set to launch the ambitious Nancy Grace Roman Telescope in May 2027. And the working relationship is by no means limited to NASA. In April, as Ars Technica reports, The U.S. Space Force awarded the company a $5.9 billion contract, making SpaceX the leading provider of launch services for Pentagon satellites. Meanwhile, some 50 military commands use SpaceX's Starlink satellite constellation for Internet, according to Defense News. We have $22 billion in government contracts, said Gwynne Shotwell, SpaceX's president and COO, in a live-streamed public panel last year. We earned that. We bid it. We were the lowest price, best bidder. We won. We execute. If anything, the company's going to have the opportunity to execute still more. In 2021, NASA selected SpaceX's still-in-development Starship rocket to serve as the lander that's planned to carry American astronauts down from lunar orbit to the surface of the moon sometime before the end of the decade. NASA also tapped SpaceX to build the vehicle that will nudge the ISS out of orbit when the program ends in 2030. And in May, Trump's so-called skinny budget called for NASA to cancel its over-budget, behind-schedule space launch system, the 21st century answer to the 1960s Saturn V moon rocket. Starship is the likeliest successor. All of this leaves SpaceX and the government mutually interdependent. That is not to say neither could not foul the nest. Trump's nomination of Musk friend Jared Isaacman as NASA administrator was widely seen as a sign of Musk's influence on the president, and Trump's decision May 31 to pull the nomination as the first sign of the rift. But as tempers cool and angry posts are deleted, what remains are interests. SpaceX investors and other customers may serve as a break on Musk's worst tendencies. And lawmakers from space-heavy states, including California, Texas, and Florida, may similarly restrain Trump. There's a photo here. It's not very large. It's quite dramatic, though. It is of the vehicle assembly building at Cape Canaveral, and the photograph is dated March 2025. It's a futuristic-looking building, quite tall, quite blocky in shape. It looks like it could be a giant concrete block that is used in building set up on end. There's a U.S. flag, probably not hanging, but probably painted on the upper left corner of the building. NASA is in the form of a circle, NASA being in white lettering upon bright blue background. There are storm clouds surrounding it, which makes this a dramatic photo. A dark gray Florida, central Florida looking clouds, just heavy with precipitation, are skimming the top of the building, and in the background there's an icy blue status quo from the sky. Okay, milestones is next, and there are three articles to be read. The first is titled Convicted. It is by Chantel Lee. Harvey Weinstein, I think that's how he pronounces it. I would pronounce it Weinstein, but I think it's a hard E on the end. Weinstein, in dramatic retrial. Disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein was convicted on one of three charges in his retrial for sex crimes, which came after his 2020 conviction was overturned by New York State's highest court. June 11, Weinstein was convicted of forcibly subjecting a person to a criminal sex act and acquitted of another sexual assault charge. A day later, the judge overseeing the proceedings declared a mistrial on the final charge of third-degree rape, after jurors were unable to reach a verdict. The decision came after the jury foreperson said he felt threatened by the other jurors and refused to return to deliberate. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg indicated his office was prepared to retry the rape charge. Weinstein was separately convicted of sexual assault in Los Angeles in 2022 and was sentenced to 16 years in prison, a verdict he is appealing. Died Sly Stone, a music protest icon. Another column here written by Andrew R. Chow. Sly Stone, who died June 9 at 82, wrung greatness out of the American abyss. Early in his career, Stone was an avatar of a more peaceful future, forming Sly and the Family Stone as one of the country's first mainstream, racially integrated bands. The group's diversity was not much, was not just skin deep, but also musical, as they fused funk, rock, soul, and psychedelia into up-tempo anthems with motivational messages. But following the assassinations of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy in 1968, as the Vietnam War dragged on and violence inside the country mounted, Stone grew increasingly disillusioned with the nation's trajectory. He channeled this discontent into his 1971 album, There's a Riot Going On, a swampy morass of funk grooves and murmured mantras that captured a socio-political undercurrent that America had long resisted acknowledging. Though it confused some reviewers, it is now revered as an influential American classic. After making the album, Stone continued to slide into addiction, depression, paranoia that had already begun. But while he may not have been a role model, he was a real model, he liked to say, and there will never be another album like Riot, the sound of a genius straining against the edges of convention, of love being found in a hopeless place. Died Brian Wilson, Beach Boy, this column by Olivia B. Waxman. The family of Brian Wilson, co-founder of the Beach Boys, said June 11 he had died at age 82. As songwriter and co-lead vocalist, Wilson had shaped the band's timeless sound, starting with the chart-climbing singles Surfin' USA and I Get Around, lifting pop music into a realm of propulsive, sunlit good feeling that defined the dream of Southern California from the 1960s to the present. But his masterpiece was the 1966 album Pet Sounds. After hearing it, the Beatles, who regarded the Beach Boys, not the Rolling Stones, as their creative rivals, went into the studio to answer it and made Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Wilson tried to top it himself, setting to work on Smile, an album he imagined as a teenage symphony to God, but mental health issues and a controlling therapist sidetracked Wilson's career. And until its 2004 release, Smile existed only as excerpts. The music is mystic, mad, wild, and gentle, quite unlike anything anyone, including Wilson, had ever tried in pop before, Times J. Cox wrote, after hearing some of the songs. The lyrics were as fleeting as a waking dream. The musical tracks were layered as if Wilson were a kid in his room, stacking 45 RPM records on top of one another. And at the bottom we have five short announcements. Died Leonard A. Lauder, L-A-U-D-E-R, known for the international cosmetics company he and his mother, Estee Lauder, created together, June 14, in his home in New York City. He was 92. Killed 9 students and a teacher during a school shooting. in Austria's second biggest city, Graz, G-R-A-Z, after a former student opened fire June 10. It is believed to be Austria's deadliest post-war attack. Announced Misty Copeland's retirement from the American Ballet Theatre. After more than two decades, Copeland, 42, will take the stage this fall for her final performance with the company. Appointed the first female leader of MI6, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, in its 116-year history, Blaise Meterweli, Meterweli, who was named chief June 15, has worked for MI6 for more than 25 years, and finally upheld a Tennessee ban on youth gender-affirming care by the U.S. Supreme Court June 18. The decision could have consequences nationwide, since 25 states have similar laws. Here is, from the last page, seven questions. Let's see if there really are seven. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Yes, indeed. Rosemary Counter writes this, and it's about Caroline Fraser, F-R-A-S-E-R, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, on her new book about serial killers, The Pacific Northwest and Toxic Chemicals. This is the question-answer format. Serial killers thrive on attention. How do you write about them without feeding the hype? Answer. This idea that serial killers are fiendishly clever is not true. We build these people up. Then when they are unveiled, they're these sad, pathetic losers. The public should see that. But would any of this make someone take up serial killing in the first place? I don't think so. Question. Your last book was a biography of Little House on the Prairie author Laura Ingalls Wilder. How do you go from that to serial killers? Answer. I was born and raised in Seattle and remember growing up with the presence of Ted Bundy. Even though I was not touched by the case directly, having it happen so close was a big deal. Bundy kidnapped and killed two women on the same Sunday afternoon from Lake Sammamish, 6 miles from me. It was all anybody could talk about, and then there were so many others. Question, did it feel like suddenly serial killers were everywhere? Answer, by the time of Richard Ramirez, people were thinking, what the hell is going on here? It is striking. Nobody was asking why. Nobody was asking, are there more killers than before? Is there something about the Pacific Northwest? The FBI was presenting themselves as experts, but they were not explaining the phenomena. Question, many theories have sought to explain it. How did you arrive at yours? Answer, I figure it's got to be a combination. Physical and sexual abuse was the leading theory of FBI profilers. A lot of these guys have a missing father, abusive father, did not know who their father was, which they blame their mothers for. As we learn about the brain, we are thinking about the effects of concussion and brain damage. Some people think forceps delivery in the 50s caused brain damage. Vitamin deficiencies can produce deficits in development. All this before we even get to the topic of chemical exposures. Question, how do you see that as a factor? Answer, during the post-war period, an enormous amount of lead was in the air from mainly leaded gas and heavy industry like smelting. It's pretty well accepted that between 20% and 50% of the rise in crime in the 1980s and 90s is attributable to lead. There's a clear association between the withdrawal of leaded gas and the drop-off of crime. Many studies connect lead exposure to a frontal cortex damage that leads to heightened aggression, observed largely in males. question, is there something specific about the Pacific Northwest? Answer, while there were smelters all over the country, Tacoma's smelter sits right in the middle of the city. All the emissions were spread in this plume up to 1,000 square miles. Crime was up in Washington State by almost 30%, three times the national average. A lot of the idea about the Northwest Pacific comes right from Bundy. He was early in this phenomena, and he talked a lot, to the point that he was mythologized. The media described him as Kennedy-esque. And finally, question, America's serial killer database counted 669 in the 90s and 117 in the 2010s. Where are they all going? Answer, a police officer will tell you we are better at catching them because of increased resources. Proponents of mass incarceration will tell you they are in jail earlier and longer. Forensic evidence makes identifying them easier, but in the same way we've built cars that are safer, we've also improved health outcomes to build better humans. Pregnant mothers take prenatal vitamins, and mental health services have improved. Thanks largely to American football, we better understand the connection between repeated blows to the head and degradation of cognition. Toxic chemicals were phased out and banned, and then the crime rate took its largest plunge. I do not think serial killers are going anywhere, as much as we did not grow them to begin with. Turning the page to review. A bombshell movie star mother with bombshell secrets. When Mariska Hargitay was 3, she and two of her brothers survived the car accident that killed their mother. Bombshell movie star Jane Mansfield. Okay, Mariska, I believe, is the way this name is pronounced. It's M-A-R-I-S-K-A. The last name, H-A-R-G-I-T-A-Y. And Jane, spelled J-A-Y-N-E, Mansfield. The kids were asleep in the back seat, three adults in front. Mansfield, her companion at the time, and the car's driver were killed instantly. Mariska's two brothers, injured, were carried away from the scene. It was not until later that one of them, 6-year-old Zoltan, realized Mariska was not with them. She was pinned beneath the passenger seat with a head injury. If Zoltan had not spoken up, Mariska might not have been found till it was too late. That is just one of the details revealed in Hargitay's touching documentary, My Mom, Jane, in which the actor, now 61, summons scraps of facts and remembrances to piece together the truth about her own identity and in the process make peace with the mother she never knew. Hargitay has known since her 20s that the man who raised her and loved her deeply, actor and bodybuilder Mickey Hargitay, was not her real father. Only now is she reckoning with the scope of that truth. My Mom Jane hopscotches through Mansfield's early life and career. She became a mother at age 16, lived in Texas with her young daughter and her first husband until she could stand it no longer. She wanted to be a movie star so badly. She was drawn to Hollywood, where she eked out a living with small film parts. Then, in 1955, she landed a starring role on Broadway in Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter? That opened the door to bigger film roles, but like the star she obviously emulated, Marilyn Monroe, Mansfield wanted desperately to be considered a serious actor. with her moonbeam-colored hair and exaggerated, breathy, speaking voice, which her children recall as seeming strange and upsetting, so different from the mom they knew at home, she settled somewhat unhappily for being a curvaceous sex symbol. Hargate, who would build her own career as an actor on TV's Law and Order Special Victims Unit, never felt comfortable with either her mother's persona or her life choices. Mansfield was only 34 at the time of her death in 1967. She and Mickey had divorced shortly after Marischka was born, though he and the woman he married after the divorce, Ellen Ciano, would end up raising Hargate and two of her brothers after Mansfield's death. Hargate's two other half-siblings also appear in the documentary, helping her cover some gaps that her research could not fill. Hargate makes it clear the life her father and stepmother made for the family was a happy one. She also explains how unsettled she felt for most of her life, unable to comprehend her mother's motivations and feeling resentment about truths that were hidden from her. Yet by the end of My Mom Jane, by which time we've also met Hargate's biological father, one-time Las Vegas entertainer Nelson Sardelli, in a sequence that's not likely to leave a dry eye in the house, Hargate's catharsis is complete. When Hargate finally and tenderly tells her mother, "I see myself in you for the first time," we know, too, more about this charming and ambitious performer whose star never burned as brightly as she had hoped. She was not our mom, but her unruly secrets reflect the uncomfortable truths that are so often hidden in our own histories. Families are made of fallible humans. That is their tragedy and their glory. And that review was written by Stephanie Zakarik. My Mom Jane started streaming on Max June 27, and at the bottom corner, not quite a fourth of a page, is a photograph of Hargate, a baby, with Jane Mansfield, an adoring mother, but one with secrets. It looks like they're playing on a sofa. And Hargate is just a little thing. Maybe she's two or so. She has long, very dark hair, bright, very dark eyes. Her little mouth is open. She's either smiling widely or laughing. She's wearing a red print dress with a white collar. And she's hugging. She's actually on the shoulders of and hugging her mom, who is in repose on this piece of furniture. And Jane Mansfield has a beautiful face. She has very dark eyes. She has very largely painted lips. They're brighter pink than her little girl's red dress. And she has this big white, it's actually white hairdo. It's kind of a bouffant deal that's been combed off to one side. Most of it's hanging on the left side of her face with only a little bit over her ear on the right side. She has bangs that are down to her very dark eyebrows. She appears to be wearing a shirt that's dark blue, navy blue, I'd say, white and gray, horizontal stripes, and she's smiling. This is just such a happy photo, and it's for My Mom Jane, a documentary, apparently. The brief news, business. The World's Most Sustainable Companies by Charlotte Hugh, or Who, is spelled H-U. In the fight against climate change, companies are navigating compounding problems. Supply chain issues, tariffs, changing government incentives for environmental programs. To track how top global firms across industries are rising to the challenge, Time and data firm Statista partnered to rank the world's 500 most sustainable companies based on their public commitment to and progress toward sustainability targets during the calendar year of 2023, the most recent year for which complete data are available. The top-ranked company on this year's list, as it was on last year's, is France-based Schneider Electric, which makes energy management software and advises other companies on how to reduce their emissions, beating out competitors like Siemens AG, GE Vernova, and ABB as the leading provider of energy grid digitalization technology. Through a program called Energize, Schneider also helped top-ranked pharmaceutical companies Sanofi, number 10, and Novartis, number 11, procure renewable energy for their operations. As a pharmaceutical manufacturer, Sanofi, that's S-A-N-O-F-I, executives know they need to do more than switch to renewable energy to cut environmental impact. Its sustainability report focuses on progressively replacing PVC with cardboard in secondary packaging and stopping use of plastic in its vaccine syringe blister packs by 2028. Currently, 55% of our vaccines are blister-free, says Sandrine Boutier-Streff, Sanofi head of corporate social responsibility. The company has also started experimenting with a reusable insulin pen. And to cut the industry-wide use of horseshoe crab blood to detect low levels of toxic bacteria in products and medicines, Sanofi has shifted to a synthetic substitute in two plants, with a third plant slated to make the switch this year. For automakers, the focus has long been clamping down on emissions, but tariffs led to bumpy roads. The highest-ranked automakers on the list, Ford, number 74, and Volvo Cars, number 91, recently revised their climate goals. Geely-owned Volvo changed its goalpost of going fully electric from 2030 to 2040, which the company elaborated on in a sustainability update in March. But all are continuing to push for progress. While we acknowledge the challenges facing the automotive sector, our strategic direction remains clear, says Vanessa Butani, head of global sustainability at Volvo Cars. Our vision remains firmly on an electric and more sustainable future. Now, here's a list of the world's most sustainable companies 2025. This was compiled by Time. I'll read them very quickly. Let's see, if we run across one from the U.S., I'll mention that. Otherwise, they're all foreign. Schneider Electric, Telefonica, Brambles, Temenos, Moncler, NRI, NEC Corp, NASDAQ, U.S., Siemens, Sanofi, Novartis, GEA Group, Illumina, U.S., ABB, it's either Aclona or Ashiona, Deutsche Telekom, Beko or Beko, B-E-K-O, Cellnex, AstraZeneca, and Train, T-R-A-N-E, Technologies. And again, there were two in that list from the U.S. The rest represent France, Spain, Australia, Switzerland, Italy, Japan, Germany, Turkey, and Ireland. Okay. The brief health. Five things to say to someone who won't get off the phone, by Angela Haupt. Trying to talk to someone fixated on their phone is such a universal experience. There is a name for it, fubbing, P-H-U-B-B-I-N-G, short for phone snubbing or ignoring someone in favor of a phone. Everyone hates it, but everyone has also done it, says Jean Twenge, a professor of psychology at San Diego State University and author of the upcoming book, 10 Rules for Raising Kids in a High-Tech World. When someone fubs you, you feel you're not important, that whatever is on their phone is more important than you. Fubbing negatively affects mental health, relationship satisfaction, overall well-being. That's why it's worth speaking up about digital distraction. It is challenging and awkward, but we should be doing this, Twenge says. We need to be confronting this situation. Here's exactly what to say when the person you are trying to talk to will not put down the phone. 1. Is everything okay? This question allows for the possibility that there is an emergency, while implying that if there is not, it would be better to put the phone down. It might feel slightly confrontational, Twenge says, but it is better than snapping at the other person to get off the device. You have to find a way to thread that needle of acknowledging that there might be something important going on, she says, but it is a call out. 2. I feel like I'm being ignored. Focusing on the way someone's phone use makes you feel can be more effective than instigatory comments, says Dr. James Scherer, co-editor of the American Psychiatric Association's Technological Addictions textbook. It won't help to bark, "You're always on TikTok, you don't care about me." Highlighting how someone's behavior makes you feel, however, plants a seed that can encourage them to reevaluate their habits. The most important thing is to approach it from a position of being non-judgmental, he says. 3. Can we take a 10-minute phone break? You are not asking them to disconnect forever. Rather, you are inviting a shared moment. People are more likely to unplug when there's a clear time boundary and a good reason, says Tessa Stuckey, a therapist and founder of Project Look Up, a nonprofit that helps families build healthier screen habits. Plus, it is collaborative, almost like you're proposing a team challenge. 4. These moments with you really matter to me. If you are at dinner with friends or are spending time with a family member you do not get to see often, consider calling attention to the significance of the moment. Tell them you miss them when they're on their phone. Or phrase it like this: "This time together deserves our full attention, don't you think?" You could even follow up by adding, "I'd hate to look back and feel like we missed out because of our screens," suggests Scherer. It can be very powerful, he says, and lead to meaningful improvements in relationship quality. And 5, muskrat. That's M-U-S-K-R-A-T. Stuckey's son was 8 when he noticed certain family members were paying more attention to their phones than to him opening his Christmas presents. He came up with an idea. The family could designate a silly code word to say every time they wanted someone to drop the devices. 6 years later, the family still uses their word, muskrat. "What I love about it is my kids can call us out using that word," Stuckey says. The View, Immigration. Choose Hope Over Fear, by Alberto M. Carvalho, C-A-R-V-A-L-H-O. I am the leader of the second largest public school system in the country. I'm also a proud American, and once I was an undocumented immigrant. My journey to citizenship is an experience that deeply informs how I lead, how I teach, how I serve the over 520,000 students who attend Los Angeles Unified Schools. This country gave me the opportunity to learn to grow and to give back. The week of June 9, I cheered as our youngest students crossed their first academic finish lines. The kindergartners beamed with pride and hugged the teachers who had helped them grow. In those moments, I saw the future, bright, diverse, full of possibility. But in the same week, I also stood beside families gripped with fear. Some of them have lived in our city for decades. Some arrived more recently, escaping violence, persecution, and poverty. All have entrusted their children to our care, and now many are facing the unimaginable. In recent months, the federal government has sent immigration agents into our communities, sometimes near or directly to schools. They've questioned parents and in some cases spoken with students. Federal immigration agents have driven through neighborhoods in tactical gear and set up checkpoints outside workplaces. In June, the National Guard was deployed to Los Angeles, then the Marines. To be clear, no preschooler, no first grader, no high school sophomore on the way to class poses any risk to the national security of the U.S. Yet, the response we're seeing looks more like a military operation than an immigration process. The result is trauma, fear, distrust, particularly in our schools, where children should feel safest. We're hearing reports of families hiding in their homes, students too afraid to come to school, parents who feel they must choose between a child's education and the risk of detention. Los Angeles Unified Schools are and will remain safe and welcoming spaces for every child, regardless of immigration status. That's not just our commitment, it's the law. The U.S. Supreme Court has held for over four decades that every child, regardless of citizenship, has a constitutional right to a free public education. That means our doors stay open. No child should miss school because of fear. School is not just a place to learn reading, math, and science. It's also the place where students receive food, mental health resources, physical care. Schools are the heart of a community. For many children, it's the only place where they feel truly safe, truly seen. When federal actions create chaos outside our school gates, it's our responsibility to protect the sanctity of what happens inside them. As a former undocumented immigrant, I know this fear. I have felt it. I've lived with the uncertainty of wondering whether a knock at the door meant separation from everything I loved. I also know what it means to be given a chance to study, to contribute, to lead. The question now is, what kind of country do we want to be? I believe we must be a nation that protects children before politics, a nation that recognizes education not as a bargaining chip, but as a birthright, a nation that honors the courage and contributions of immigrant families who are the backbone of our workforce, our schools, and our future. We need federal policies that are humane, lawful, and consistent with our values. That means halting enforcement actions near schools and community centers. It means clear communication with local jurisdictions. It means permanent protections for Dreamers and long-term immigration reform grounded in dignity and opportunity, not fear. Locally, we must continue investing in services that support our students: mental health care, trauma-informed counseling, family legal support, robust outreach, so families know their rights and know they're not alone. And to the voters reading this, your voice matters. We cannot build a just education system without a just immigration system. The next election, at every level, will help decide whether our schools remain sanctuaries of learning or become battlegrounds for political theater. I will do everything in my power to make sure every child, documented or not, feels safe, supported, and seen in our schools. The future of this country sits in our classrooms every day, and how we treat them will define who we are and what happens next in our nation. We can choose fear, or we can choose hope. The author, Alberto M. Carvalho, has served as superintendent of Los Angeles Unified School District since February 2022. The U.S. tradition of repressing protest by Shira, S-H-I-R-A, Lurie, L-U-R-I-E, who's author of the American Liberty Pole, P-O-L-E, Popular Politics and the Struggle for American Democracy in the Early Republic. While American history is full of those claiming the revolutionary right to resist, it's also full of officials fighting to shut them down. George Washington came down hard on the Whiskey Rebellion, a 1794 tax revolt in western Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Maryland by frontiersmen who claimed to be keeping alive the spirit of 76. The president led 15,000 federalized militiamen west and arrested hundreds. All were pardoned, but the government had made its point. Such displays of opposition were not allowed. President John Adams used the same playbook when another tax rebellion broke out in Pennsylvania, dispatching 3,000 troops. In addition, Adams used the sedition law to jail opponents. Though the main target was newspaper editors, the harshest sentence, 2 years, was served by a man who led protests to Adams' policies. Government officials and police have attempted to muzzle activists fighting for every progressive cause in the nation's history, from abolition to LGBTQ+ rights. Perhaps we should understand the revolution not as the birth of an American protest tradition, but as its death knell. In the early years of the Republic, a tradition of repressing dissent arose alongside dissent itself. In that sense, those who appeal to founding principles to counter recent authoritarian tactics are on a fool's errand. As Americans courageously rise to protest, they're engaging in a 250-year-old battle, pitting the people against a state that may wish to silence them. And finally, the founders saw the dangers of concentrated wealth by Daniel Mandel, M-A-N-D-E-L-L, who's author of The Lost Tradition of Economic Equality in America, 1600 to 1870. This will be abridged. As the U.S. approaches its 250th year, the richest 10% hold over 67% of household wealth and increasingly seem entitled to power and privilege. This would horrify the founders, who believed great wealth would corrupt their republic. Their beliefs were shaped by sources including Roman historians who blamed the empire's decline on such inequality, English radical Whigs who decried the corruption of British politics, Enlightenment philosophers like John Locke who argued individuals should not hoard wealth. These ideals held particular power because they reflected the experiences of most British Americans. Lands taken from Indians provided a remarkable level of economic and social equality among settlers, resulting in a far higher percentage of white adult men voting than in England. Even the wealthiest southern planters needed the support of poorer, yet property holder neighbors. The widespread embrace of these ideas was demonstrated in 1748 when the Independent Advertiser reprinted Cato's letters to warn that when a man's wealth became immeasurably or surprisingly great, the community should oblige them to surrender part. But will some say, is it a crime to be rich? Yes, certainly. Samuel Adams published the Advertiser for Boston working men who had beaten off Navy press gangs and were concerned about increasing poverty. 16 years later, they would become his Sons of Liberty. In a 1773 Connecticut election sermon, Benjamin Trumbull warned the community needed to keep property as equally divided as possible to avoid the tyranny of a wealthy few. 3 years later, such a measure proposed by Benjamin Franklin nearly became part of Pennsylvania's first constitution. After the war, many Americans believed they lived in the most egalitarian country ever because of, as Noah Webster wrote, the general and tolerably equal distribution of landed property. But they also feared a future aristocracy of wealth. By 1800, nearly every state had abolished entail, permanent barriers to altering property, and primogeniture, total inheritance by the eldest son, in order to encourage the division of property. Unfortunately, this focus on land overlooked the growing role of financial wealth. As trade and manufacturing flourished, power was increasingly measured in dollars rather than acres. When wage labor and inequality increased in the early 1800s, states extended the vote to white men, regardless of property. This severed the connection between property and polity, relieving pressure to limit wealth while making the racial barrier explicit. But America's egalitarian tradition would be revived by working men's parties in the late 1820s, communitarian efforts in the 1840s, calls in the mid-1860s to redistribute Confederate plantations to freed men, and labor and farmer movements into the 20th century. The last article was slightly abbreviated. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.